Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson. And today on the program, I'll be talking with George Doherty, founder of the Rocky Mountain Regional Disaster Mental Health Institute, which has a yearly conference to provide opportunities for first responders and disaster mental health professionals to present and learn from each other, share ideas and experiences, and to network with each other. He's here today to talk about the conference and his new book, The Proceedings of the Sixth Rocky Mountain Regional Disaster Mental Health Conference, which is out now on Loving Healing Press. George Doherty resides in Laramie, Wyoming, where he founded the Rocky Mountain Regional Disaster Mental Health Institute. He is the president and CEO of this organization and also serves as clinical coordinator of the Snowy Range Assist Critical Incident Stress Management Team. George has been involved with disaster relief since 1995, serving as a disaster mental health specialist with such incidents as the UP train wreck in Laramie, Wyoming, Hurricane Fran in North Carolina, and the Cincinnati floods in Falmouth, Kentucky. He served as supervisor for disaster mental health for flash floods in Fort Collins, Colorado, and spent a month as the Red Cross disaster mental health coordinator for Western Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane George. He has extensive experience conducting critical incident stress management debriefings. George has also published numerous articles in disaster mental health and traumatic stress publications and served as guest editor for two special editions of the journal Traumatology. In addition, George served as an officer in the U.S. Air Force and was an OTS instructor and squadron commander. He also served 11 years involved in air research and rescue with Civil Air Patrol in Wyoming. He is a licensed professional counselor in private practice and has been an adjunct instructor for a number of colleges, including Warren National University and the University of Wyoming. So I am happy to have George on the phone today. Thanks for joining us, George.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, that is quite an introduction, and I know that your bio is even more extensive than that. I had a hard time almost getting through it. So you have quite a history in disaster relief, and I'd like to know, actually, how you have seen over the years, and maybe over the past 10 years, how this arena has really changed.
Well, actually, it goes back a little bit longer than 10 years and stuff. The disaster mental health field itself has grown quite a bit as a result of the better awareness that people have following critical incidents and disasters. And this is a result of one incident with Hurricane Andrew back in the early 90s when folks decided that responders needed a little bit more, you know, help and assistance on the job.
Where was that hurricane?
That was Hurricane Andrew.
Was that in North?
It was the one in Florida.
Oh.
Was in the early 1990s. I apologize for not having the exact
name. Oh, no. That's fine. So tell us about the Rocky Mountain Conference, the Regional Disaster Mental Health Conference. Why you started this organization, the Institute, and the conference, and what its purpose really is.
Conference itself started back in 1999, was the first one we had here in Laramie itself, and we had that on the campus here at the University of Wyoming. At that time, there were not too many people in the country who were presenting information about disaster mental health to mental health professionals and first responders, so we decided we were going to try and fill that gap, and the first one we had was a pretty big conference.
Mm-hmm.
It was, in fact, the largest one we've had in folks, and we've had it for a number of years now. The seventh one will be this coming November in Laramie here.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we were in Cheyenne, and we try to rotate it around a little bit. But the purpose of it is to provide a forum for presentation of things like research results, education, training, and consultation that's available in disaster mental health services and critical incident stress management. We also like to highlight things like advances in the delivery of these and give people a chance to discuss this with each other, pass on information, network a bit, and we also do continuing education for professionals and volunteers at the conferences that we do, and we usually get people from different parts of the country, not just our region.
Mm. Well, I was wondering if people were coming from all over the U.S. or if this was just the central part of the country.
No, we do get folks from different parts of the country. In fact, we have one or two that came from Texas this last year. I was actually on the phone yesterday with a colleague of mine who's presented at our conference about three or four times now. And he's from San Angelo, of all places.
Oh, wow.
We were discussing for about a couple hours yesterday on the phone the situation that's, you know, pretty prominent down there right now.
Yes, yes. Everyone knows where San Angelo, Texas is right now.
Yes, it's not something that most folks knew about before. But we try to provide opportunities for the responders and to learn from each other and to share the experiences. We do get actually even people come from other countries, from England, for example, and India. We've had presenters from there and Australia, I think Canada and one or two other countries we've had people over the years. So we do reach out a little bit further than just the Rocky Mountains in that area.
How many people attended this last conference?
Well, we've gotten a little bit smaller in terms of our attendance over the last couple of years because other people are doing similar things around the country, which is great. You know, it's something we were promoting back in 99. But we had about 75 to 100 people.
That's still quite a bit.
Well, yes, it is. Yeah, we try to provide them with the opportunities and to discuss and have a little bit more intimate contact with each other and network and after the presentations are made. Something with table, we call them tabletop discussions and stuff.
What kind of people, like with their backgrounds and their professions, are coming to this conference?
The first responders are usually firefighters, law enforcement, EMTs. We have chaplains that attend it, mental health professionals, and we do have military personnel that attend our conferences. We've been trying the last number of years because of military involvement over in the Middle East and our troops being over there and coming back. We've tried to highlight some of that information, and we're very, very concerned about our military veterans coming back home and having follow-up with people, and so we're trying to make sure we get the veterans organizations who attend our conferences and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
We cover all those.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the importance of disaster mental health. Your focus really is based primarily on responders and their families, from what I understand.
Well, that's our primary mission. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We're also interested in the people who are directly affected. I don't want to the term victim is a bothersome term sometimes, but we're talking about the people that are directly affected, for example, you know, as well. So we're concerned about their well-being because our people are also responders, you know, to
good
them.
Point.
So, you know, we try to focus, like I say, our primary mission is on the responders to make sure that they are able to do the job and to stay on the job. We don't want to lose them. And first responders deal with some very difficult things on a daily basis that most people probably would have a difficulty doing. They're trained to do this, but every once in a while there are some incidents that occur that are a little bit beyond what they would consider, you know, their everyday normal things. For example, Oklahoma City bombing, the 9/11 incident in New York, Hurricane Katrina, and the events down there that go a little bit beyond things. And there's a lot of training that goes into getting our responders to up to where they are doing these jobs, protecting us from fire and the law enforcement and other groups like that, nurses. And we want to make sure, because of the money involved, for one, in training them, the experience they have, we don't want to lose these folks.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain stressors that, you know, that they encounter. So that's part of what we are trying to make sure that they are able to handle that and that they, you know, they don't get overwhelmed as well. Because when our responders, whether they're military or civilian, become too overwhelmed, then we wind up with other problems like post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that everyone in a disaster type of situation is going to have some sort of response that will need to be dealt with?
Everybody that is exposed to a critical incident or a disaster is going to be affected by it at some level. Some people are able to handle it a little bit better than others. Sometimes people have more difficulty getting through it. Most people, whether they're responders or others, after a period of time, short period of time, they get back on track and things start, you know, working out. They're very resilient in that regard. There's always one or two that may have some difficulties with it, and those are folks we want to make sure that we don't let fall through the holes in the ground or whatever, and make sure that we direct them toward getting some assistance or some help for that. It's normal to respond that way, okay, because people who are affected by a disaster or critical incident are experiencing what we call a normal response to an abnormal situation. And it's important to recognize that, because after a period of time, they will bounce back, and if they don't bounce back from that, then they're going to be experiencing prolonged traumatic stress.
Yeah.
And if that stays around too long, it becomes what we generally call a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, so there is a period of time after that stressful event that you can actually deal with the response and basically curtail it before it turns into a full-blown PTSD
Correct.
Situation. Interesting.
Right, yeah. If you look, you know, not to get too technical here for your listeners, but the Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Psychological Problems and Disorders spells out certain criteria for a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, and one of the ones is the time element. If these events, depression and anxiety and some of the other symptoms that are outlined in there go for more than 30 days and are not resolving themselves, then that's when we would consider the diagnosis of a post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's when we would suggest that the people involved, the first responders or anyone, seek additional help from a mental health professional.
Are you putting any emphasis on long-term support to ensure that post-traumatic stress disorder hasn't taken effect? Because I imagine there may be some people that slip through the cracks to begin with.
Well, that's always true. I mean, sometimes these things do not erupt, sometimes for weeks, months, or sometimes even
years
later.
Yeah.
First of all, we try to do a lot of education on what to look for among the people we call peers, who are the first responders themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a lot of training with them, and they're all integrally involved in our conferences as well, so that they know what to look for, not just among themselves, but among their peers, so they can advise their peers appropriately. And firefighters, law enforcement, nurses, and others are going to listen to their peers before they're going to listen to a mental health professional.
That's
one reason why we train them in this. But the other part is we also give them options as to what treatments are available and who to seek help from. In the education that we do with them, we try to tell them what to look for specifically so that they know, and we say this way, so that they know if they are experiencing for bad dreams, for example, or intrusive thoughts that may come, or some things that pop up at a later time, that they can relate that back and see where it comes from. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We learned a lot about post-traumatic stress disorder after Vietnam, with Vietnam vets who experienced that. And one of the things that was frightening with them, with some of them over time, was that sometimes years later they would have this all of a sudden thing just pop up from nowhere, and it was scary. And it can be very scary when things happen, especially if they're bad dreams or certain types of intrusive types of thoughts. If we know someplace where they might be coming from, it can be easier to explain and understand. They still need to get some assistance, but if they do not know where it comes from, it can be very scary.
Very much so. Is there any way to screen responders that will be involved with disaster relief? You know, I imagine that some individuals, it will be obvious that they'll handle stress better than others.
Yes, it is good to have a bit of a screening device for people who do respond. Usually, The people that respond to these things on a regular basis are firefighters, are law enforcement people, mm-hmm. nursing people and stuff, EMTs, et cetera, and even chaplains have this type of training and screening in their training as they go. That doesn't mean that they're invulnerable, okay, or not these things couldn't happen to them, but they are a little bit more aware. Mm-hmm. The ones who probably need a little more screening are folks who would be wanting to volunteer from their job to work on a disaster of sorts, and for example, Red Cross personnel or others or Salvation Army or other groups that do this, and they would probably want to look at their folks a little bit closer and do a little bit more training in terms of the stress things to look for in those situations, because as they are exposed to this, they may be unaware of what's happening to them, so they need to become aware. And the screening process itself, there are formal ones and there's informal ones, but anybody who is responding to a disaster of any type should be screened by the organization to the extent that they're aware of how well this person can handle things, so they can put them on the right type of a position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't want to put them on the front lines necessarily,
right,
if they're a very vulnerable type person, but that doesn't mean they can't respond. They can do administrative things, and these are all important jobs.
Yes.
Responding.
Most definitely. So tell us what psychological first aid means.
The term psychological first aid is being used a lot more lately. We've been doing this for some time, but it's a little bit easier to explain it to people if we use a term that people are a little bit more familiar with. If you look at physical first aid, if somebody cuts their finger or somebody gets a broken leg or something, we have people that are trained in providing first aid on site, doing some, you call them bandaging or Band-Aid things,
mm-hmm.
and doing some triage to see whether or not a person can go back to work on a prolonged event with a cut finger or something, or if they've got a broken leg, maybe they need to go home in that. So we understand physical first aid very well. What we're talking about with psychological first aid are the emotional components, and how is the person responding emotionally to this particular event. And we have a saying, the physical first aid is surgery, psychological first aid is the therapy.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
In other words, what we're doing there is providing a quick fix on the job for something that may or may not be minor. If it's determined that this person is emotionally or having difficulties for whatever reasons functioning, then we need to pull them off the line in a prolonged event, or in any event following it. We are providing a triage type of a situation so that we can determine what types of further aid to provide or refer them to. We train our responders as well as our mental health professionals that to do this first aid on the job. We're not doing therapy when we're working in a disaster or critical incident, because you can't. Therapy is a very involved process,
mm-hmm.
okay, and it's not something you can do right there on the site. You can provide the first aid there and stabilize the situation and stabilize the person as you would in a physical situation, and then if they are able to function after a period of time, a little bit of rest maybe, then they can go back in and work on it. If they are having difficulties that are beyond that, then we refer out.
And so what are some of the areas that you would refer to?
That would depend on the local area and the resources available.
Okay.
We would refer them to a mental health center, or if in some cases an EAP programs have counseling programs, some certain groups have that, and EAP meaning employee assistance programs, or some organizations have a psychologist, a counselor, or a therapist that they work with on a regular basis, and you know, people are a little bit more comfortable if they know somebody to refer them to that person or organization group that they work with locally, because it may be a longer term thing that they're working with there.
Mm-hmm.
But I always kind of like to I don't know if you're a fan of MASH.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've ever looked at some of those episodes they have there, that's a lot of what they are doing in addition to their medical triage. They're doing some psychological triage there and some of their emotional things. So it's not a new concept. The name is a little new, but it's something that's been there for a while.
For a while. Mm-hmm. How interesting. So are there different considerations when you're talking about a natural disaster compared to more of a man-made disaster like war?
Mm-hmm. Okay, natural disasters, people can accept that a little bit more because it's quote-unquote an act of God.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they are a little bit better able to justify why it happened. It still affects them quite a bit. I mean, a tornado that comes through town unexpectedly is going to affect the people, especially the ones who have lost a home or a loved one. In that incident, the hurricane, the same thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Man-made disaster, then we've got somebody to blame, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can get mad at God, but, about the other ones, and that is the process sometimes, but that's a grieving process for most folks. But when it's a man-made thing, especially with war, there's a lot of other controversies that go on with that as well. And there are people that we talk about a good example is New Orleans with the Katrina. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's not a man-made, it was a natural disaster, and it started as that, but then it developed into something a lot bigger.
True.
Oklahoma City, as an example, a terrorist act that occurred there, or a terrorist act with 9/11, these were caused by people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so people get a lot more angry, they start pointing fingers, it's a little bit more involved. But there is a difference between the two. It's easier for folks to accept the natural disaster because it comes from natural causes.
I imagine with the man-made disasters, it's a much more extensive process. And I imagine you being so involved in disaster relief, this is a big topic at your conferences.
Yes, it is. We try, we try to make some distinctions there. And most of the people that attend our conferences who have had experience in this, okay, at
mm-hmm.
some level, even if it's just one incident they responded to, they are pretty much aware of a lot of those differences, and they do discuss them, and they do talk them through quite a bit, the effects that they're having.
Mm-hmm. So talk to us about family support and how you're addressing the issue of families of responders.
Okay. Responders' families are affected a lot of times as much and sometimes maybe even more than the responder themselves.
That's interesting. You wouldn't think that.
A firefighter, for example, who is on call 24/7,
okay?
Especially mm-hmm. when it's a volunteer thing. Like, we have a lot of stuff in our part of the country with wildfires and things. I'm sure you do in Texas as well.
Yeah.
But the person who has to go off immediately, okay, to something, or the family, the support they receive from the family, from their spouse, or from the children, if they're younger children versus older children, if they're not able to be there for a child's sporting event because an incident occurred, these cause stresses. And if they're working in a particularly dangerous environment, fires or law enforcement people whose lives are at risk maybe at certain times, the family's concerned about those things. If it's a particularly large incident, then we like to make sure that the families get updates and information about that, and even to the point of doing what we call a debriefing with the families and providing them information, letting them talk about what's affecting them in the group. So it's important that we don't leave families out
mm-hmm.
on this
mm-hmm.
Because the husband or the wife is the one that's responding to something
mm-hmm.
or other events. And over time, and we do education with them as well, so that they know what to look for. If there's a prolonged stress from their spouse, and they're noticing some things, maybe, you know, bad dreams coming up. And
yeah.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with George Doherty, author of Proceedings of the 6th Rocky Mountain Regional Disaster Mental Health Conference. You can find out more about George through his website, www.rmrinstitute.org. I imagine for children as well, with maybe one of their parents being gone and not understanding, and then they come back, and if that responder, that parent, is having a hard time dealing with that stress. You know that kids notice the change in their parent as well. So with children, are you working with children?
Well, we don't work directly with children, but we're not ignoring them either. We let folks know some of the things to look for.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the areas we do this, in, especially in the conferences, we usually have some people. The one big example I can think of right now is, of course, our military personnel.
Yeah.
The regular military has a very good infrastructure that's been there for a long time for support services. In this particular situation, this last few years, we have had a lot of National Guard personnel that have been deployed, and the National Guard is not used to that as much as the regular military because it's not a career for them. They work in the civilian sector, and they're there as to help with situations that come up when called by the president or by the, you know, the, whatever the incident is, and the Guard does a lot of training and things. But when they're deployed, like they've been for a year or more, and then one or more tours of duty that they go to, they're dealing with the stresses in their environment over there on a daily basis, 24/7, and they're in danger. And the families are aware of this, and one of the groups that we have that presents at our conference and that we totally support is our the Family Services for the National Guard, specifically here in Wyoming. And we usually have them come and talk to our group so that people in the civilian sector of responding here, especially our mental health personnel, are aware of what resources are out there, because Wyoming is very, for example, is a very rural environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of small towns scattered around the state, and we have a lot of people that there's a good support for them for returning military personnel, but if they live in the western part of the state, and most of the facilities and things are in the eastern part of the state, it's about 400 something miles to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to get our people train enough so that they can support the families in events like that and other events.
Yes, yes. You know, you're mentioning the National Guard. I'm wondering if the military has changed its responder mental health program or its disaster relief programs with more military involvement that is beginning to happen in these types of disasters.
Well, traditionally, the National Guard has always helped out in individual states around the country when an event occurs. within the state and giving support. Unfortunately, within the last few years, they've been shorthanded because of the events in the Middle East on doing that, and that puts a lot of strain on the other responders in a lot of ways to make sure that we have it all covered. I'm sorry, I forgot. There was a second part of your question that I just...
I'm just wondering how it may have changed over the years. And, you know, especially with the situation that you're talking about in the Middle East, you know, we're seeing troops come back. There are high incidents of post-traumatic stress that is happening. So I'm wondering if the military has changed any of its disaster relief programs due to the changes that we're seeing right now.
Well, the primary one I can think right now is just the lack of resources being available stateside for that, because everything is deployed over there. We're fighting in two different theaters over there. Give you some idea of what happens here in Wyoming, because our National Guard has deployed over the years to different parts of the world because they have a lot of medical people they do things with, and they do a lot of humanitarian work and stuff. The military did an excellent job, I think, in responding to the tsunami a couple years ago and provided the Navy going there. And I believe what they've got is desalination plants that on board some of their ships, which was very helpful to folks at that point, which is, you know, kind of nice to have that. They have been trying to keep up with it from what I'm seeing. I know they respond to things, but their primary mission is to support the military personnel first.
Okay.
And I think they are, from what I've seen, they are trying very hard to avoid some of the problems that have encountered in the past, for example, in Vietnam, and to learn from some of those events so that our troops coming home, you know, are better supported.
Okay.
In that, you know, without getting too political there as well, because there's... there's some things that Congress probably needs to do to support our troops coming home with a GI Bill.
A little better, that's quite a controversial topic right now, and it really adds added importance for stateside programs like what you're...
We need to look after the people we send over there to do the job after they come home.
We need to
provide them support and assistance wherever we can. Not just through the military and not just through the Veterans Administration, but in the whole civilian sector, because these are, you know, friends, relatives, and associates that we've worked with and we've known all our lives, to be able to give them the support that they're giving us.
Yes. So tell us what critical incident stress management is. Is that what you're talking about, that triage kind of a situation?
That's part of it. Critical incident stress management itself is something is a strategic approach. I kind of like to look at it like an umbrella.
Okay.
And it covers a whole multitude of things. Okay. And underneath that umbrella are a number of what we would call tactical intervention. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And those tactical interventions would be things such as a group interventions or individual interventions. We call the peer interactions with each other, we call those one-on-one, where they can do kind of like a, you know, how you doing today, or is this bothering you type, and talk with their peers about things and make those kinds of assessments and do the psychological first aid that we've been talking about. Another type of a tactical intervention are some of the group ones, and that would be, for example, what we call a critical incident stress debriefing. And that is the people who have responded to a particular incident, whether it be a car accident, a big car accident, or a hazmat situation or whatever it is, that they can get together a day or two, a couple days usually, about within 36 to 72 hours is ideal, following the event, to sit down with a critical incident stress management team and talk about some of the things that are about the event itself. And that is designed to try and prevent some of the post-traumatic stress things we were talking about. There's a model that follows a number of steps within that debriefing that we work them through, take them from the cognitive level down into the emotional things, try to deal with that, and up then back into the, give them some suggestions about what to look for and how to deal with it and where to go if they need more help.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a valuable tool to have. It is not a critique of the event. It is strictly for the emotional aspects. We also have some of the other examples of some of these other tactical interventions we talk about. A crisis management briefing, which is like a town meeting. And you'll see that a lot of times. That one's used a lot by groups when there's a big event. And sometimes you'll have the mayor or somebody in there, you know, on that group talking to people about it.
Mm-hmm.
The best example I can think of at this point is when there's a big range fire or a forest fire or something like this, and people are evacuated, and there's usually people that will get together and give them updates on it. That's what a crisis management people informed about what's going on. We also do family, and we have something pastoral crisis intervention or spiritual for our pastors and chaplains to talk with people about. There's about 10 or 11 different what we call tactical interventions there. And when we get a call for an incident, our teams that are developed that are going to respond to it, before they respond, they will look at the event, they will do an assessment of the event, and they'll come up with a strategic plan that will include identifying the target groups that they would be able to deal with, the resources they have available to do that, when is the best time to do it, a number of other factors. That's their strategic plan so that they don't just run out willy-nilly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How do you identify potential threats or these target populations or groups? And what would some of the key groups that you're presently looking at, what would they be?
If you look at a traditional target, the circles.
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess the best example I can give you, because of the terminology that they've used a lot, might be something like the Ground Zero. Look at 9/11.
Okay.
And the people who were closest to the event itself, okay,
mm-hmm.
physically closest to it, are what we would consider to be the prime target, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then with concentric circles out, we would look at different groups that were involved and what levels they were involved at and what we suspect might be the response they may have. So that as you move out, and in that event, that was a national event, the people who were right there at Ground Zero are probably going to be the most affected. The ones maybe a mile or two or something away, they're going to be affected as well, but not quite the same way. And you move out from those all the way in a national event like that, for example, until you get out to other parts of the country who have only a vicarious exposure to it through television or radio or other ways that they know about it, and how are they dealing with it. So you want to deal with the groups that were closest to the event first, and that's why, for example, we deal with responders who were right there actually on the event first, okay?
Yeah.
Now, there's a whole bunch of people. Not one team can do all this, okay? That's why it takes a little bit of communication and planning ahead of time to deal with that, and that's why we train them, and that's why we have exercises as well.
I imagine there was a lot learned from 9/11. In
yes,
regards to responding to disaster.
Yes, there was. And putting that information together with responses to other groups, for example, the Oklahoma City, Hurricane Katrina, and local events even, that's why it's important for our responders and our mental health personnel who are involved in these things to be able to get together and talk about these and share this information. And that's one reason why we have that conference every year.
Mm-hmm. You know, I understand that one of the greatest benefits that came out of this sixth annual conference was in the area of resilience and resilience training. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Okay, the resilience training, and resilience is the ability to bounce back after an event or a situation, and it's not just individuals but communities as well. And again, an example would be New Orleans and their resilience and ability to bounce back versus maybe some other part of the country that may have better resources or more different types of training. Training people in resilience, especially especially responders ahead of time is something that we need to do. We can do that through exercises. We can do it through training. We can do it by talking about it, sharing information with each other as to what worked here and how did this work there. And a lot of it for individuals involves something in, traditionally we've talked about the individual strength themselves. And this, again, ties back into the post-traumatic stress. Some people can bounce back from a highly stressful event a lot faster than some other people. Some other people, just responders or non-responders, need maybe a little bit of support, help to get back, you know, to functioning on their normal level of or their of responding or life. But most people. Who have suffered a traumatic event or experience, and most of us do at some point in our lives, will bounce back after time, after a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, others take a little bit longer and need more assistance. But we train people, especially our responders, to develop this type of thing, over time.
Interesting. So your book, Proceedings of the Sixth Rocky Mountain Region Disaster Mental Health Conference, what can readers expect from this, and who really is the target audience? Is this more for the professional, or is this a book for everybody?
It's not necessarily just for the professional, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Even though some of the articles are written in a scientific type notation, I mean, we try each of our presenters presented in different areas, and for example, we had, I think the lead article is on suicide among law enforcement.
Oh, interesting.
We had another one of our keynote addressers. She was the Critical Incident Stress Management Coordinator nationally for the Civil Air Patrol, who does air search and rescue. And a number of other groups. It's kind of a varied group. I think that an interested general population person who wants to read it could probably get some things out of it without a lot of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't find it too overly technical. They may need to learn some more things about how different responders respond, and that would be good. Professional people that respond to it, it's a varied group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to stay away from being too technical in it, because if we are, we're going to lose our responders too.
That's true. Yeah.
But we've got to have a certain amount of academia in there, because otherwise we'll lose our mental health professionals.
That's true. You have to have a little bit in there for everybody.
Right. That's what we try to do.
You know,
we try to do that, and we also try at our conferences to have a little fun too.
You have to have fun when you're talking about this kind of an issue.
Yeah. Well, when we go to different places, we have an entertainment thing one night. You know, from the local area. We were up in Casper last year, and the tourism board people up there were very kind to us. They provided us with our reception at the Casper Events Center, and they also provided us with a couple of historical figures who came and told us the history of Casper.
Oh, wow.
So, and they did it in dress, you know, period dress.
Oh, that's great.
So we do things like that. We had a conference in Estes Park a couple years ago in Colorado, and we did that one in October so everybody could get to see the elk.
Oh, wow.
Things, and we had a number of other stuff. So we try to do things that, you know, because the people who come to this, you know, they deal with this stuff every day, mm-hmm. and it's okay to come and present this and learn more stuff, but sometimes, too, it's good to have, we'd like to give them some downtime so that they can get away from that.
Oh, you have to have balance, most definitely.
Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you also wrote a book on last year's conference, the Proceedings from the Fifth Conference?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was the focus on that, at that conference?
Well, the focus on that one was also on resilience.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Not specifically the same. I'm trying to remember the exact title of it now.
Mm-hmm.
Last year we had a little bit different focus. We try to have a little different focus every year. the papers, we did have one presenter who presented some information on the incident at Abu Ghraib, for example, last year.
Mm-hmm.
And last year we had a presenter that came from Israel who was actually a filmmaker, was doing a documentary in a nightclub in Israel, and when a suicide bomber came in and blew himself up. So he gave us a first-hand account of what happened with that.
Wow.
And a number of events.
So it's pretty current. You're dealing at these conferences with very, very current issues.
Yes, we try to. Yes. Mm-hmm. We try to do it so that we can have people updated on stuff.
Yeah.
We've had a lady from comes from England. She actually was a responder to the tsunami over in Sri Lanka and Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And she has been presenting the last three conferences because she goes back every year to do some follow-up with children over there.
Interesting. I'm sure that they're learning a lot over there as time passes from that disaster.
Yes, and she's a valuable asset for us in that, you know, in things.
Definitely.
So, you know, and 2 years, I guess it was maybe 3 years ago now, yes, we had done one.
Blog Talk Radio.